Chapter 7 Music and Plastic 1. The Arts of Form 1. The clearest type of symbolic expression that the world feeling of higher mankind has found for itself is, if we accept the mathematical scientific domain of presentation and the symbolism of its basic ideas, that of the arts of form, of which the number is legion. And with these arts we count music in its many and very dissimilar kinds. Had these been brought within the domain of art historical research, instead of being put in a class apart from that of the pictorial plastic arts, we should have progressed very much further in our understanding of the import of this evolution towards an end. For the formative impulse that is at work in the wordless arts can never be understood until we come to regard the distinction between optical and acoustic means as only a superficial one. Extended footnote. As soon as the word, which is a transmission agent of the understanding, comes to be used as the expression agent of an art, the waking consciousness ceases to express or to take in a thing integrally. Not to mention the red word of higher cultures, the medium of literature proper, even the spoken word, when used in any artificial sense, separates hearing from understanding. For the ordinary meaning of the word also takes a hand in the process, and as this art grows in power, the wordless arts themselves arrive at expression methods in which the motifs are joined to word meanings. Thus arises the allegory, or motif that signifies a word, as in Baroque sculpture after Bernini. So too painting very often develops into a sort of painting writing, as in Byzantium after the Second Nicene Council, 787, which took from the artist his freedom of choice and arrangement. This also is what distinguishes the arias of Gluck, in which the melody grew up out of the meaning of the libretto, from those of Alessandro Scarlatti, in which the texts are in themselves of no significance and mostly serve to carry the voices. The High Gothic counterpoint of the 13th century is entirely free from any connection with words. It is a pure architecture of human voices in which several texts, Latin and vernacular, sacred and secular, were sung together. End of extended footnote. To talk of the art of the eye and the art of the ear takes us no further. It is not such things that divide one art from another. Only the 19th century could so overestimate the influence of physiological conditions as to apply it to expression, conception, or communion. A singing picture of Claude Lorraine or of Watteau does not really address itself to the bodily eye any more than the space-straining music since Bach addresses itself to the bodily ear. The classical relation between artwork and sense organ, of which we so often and so erroneously remind ourselves here, is something quite different from, something far simpler and more material than ours. We read Othello and Faust, and we study orchestral scores. That is, we change one sense agency for another in order to let the undiluted spirit of these works take effect upon us. Here there is always an appeal from the outer senses to the inner, to the truly Faustian and wholly unclassical power of imagination. Only thus can we understand Shakespeare's ceaseless change of scene as against the classical unity of place. In extreme cases indeed, for instance in that of Faust itself, no representation of the work, that is, of its full content, is physically possible. But in music too, in the unaccompanied a cappella of the Palestrina style, as well as the a fortiori in the Passions of Heinrich Schütz, in the fugues of Bach, in the last quartets of Beethoven and in Tristan, we livingly experience behind the sensuous impressions a whole world of others. And it is only through these latter that all the fullness and depth of the work begins to be present to us. And it is only mediately through the images of blonde, brown, dusky and golden colours, of sunsets and distant ranked mountain summits, of storms and spring landscapes, of founded cities and strange faces which harmony conjures up for us, that it tells us something of itself. It is not an incident that Beethoven wrote his last works when he was deaf. Deafness merely released him from the last fetters. For this music, sight and hearing equally are bridges into the soul, and nothing more. To the Greek, this visionary kind of artistic enjoyment was utterly alien. He felt the marble with his eye, and the thick tones of an aulos moved him almost corporally. For him, eye and ear are the receivers of the whole of the impression that he wished to receive. But for us, this had ceased to be true even at the stage of Gothic. In the actual, tones are something extended, limited, and numerable, just as lines and colours are. Harmony, melody, rhyme, and rhythm, no less so than perspective, proportion, chiaroscuro, and outline. The distance separating two kinds of painting can be infinitely greater than that separating the painting and the music of a period. Considered in relation to a statue of Myron, the art of a Poussin landscape is the same as that of a contemporary chamber cantata, that of Rembrandt as that of the organ works of Buxtehude, Pachelbel, and Bach, that of Guardi as that of a Mozart opera. The inner form language is so nearly identical that the difference between optical and acoustic means is negligible. The importance which the science of art has always attached to a timeless and conceptual delimitation of the individual art spheres only proves that the fundamentals of the problem have not been attacked. Arts are living units, and the living is incapable of being dissected. The first act of the learned pedant has always been to partition the infinitely wide domain into provinces determined by perfectly superficial criteria of medium and technique, and to endow these provinces with eternal validity and immutable form principles. Thus he separated music and painting, music and drama, painting and sculpture. And then he proceeded to define the art of painting, the art of sculpture, and so on. But in fact, the technical form language is no more than the mask of the real work. Style is not what the shallow Semper, worthy contemporary of Darwin and materialism, supposed it to be, the product of material, technique, and purpose. It is the very opposite of this, something inaccessible to art reason, a revelation of the metaphysical order, a mysterious must, a destiny. With the material boundaries of the different arts, it has no concern whatever. To classify the arts according to the character of the sense impression, then, is to pervert the problem of form in its very enunciation. For how is it possible to predicate a genus sculpture of so general a character as to admit of general laws being evolved from it? What is sculpture? Take painting again. There is no such thing as the art of painting. And anyone who compares a drawing of Raphael, effected by outline, with one of Titian, effected by flecks of light and shade, without feeling that they belong to two different arts, anyone who does not realize a dissimilarity of essence between the works of Giotto or Mantegna, relief created by brushstroke, and those of Vermeer or Goya, music created on coloured canvas, such a one will never grasp the deeper questions. As for the frescoes of Polygnotis and the mosaics of Ravenna, there is not even the similarity of technical means to bring them within the alleged genus. And what is there in common between an etching and the art of Fra Angelico, or a proto-Corinthian vase painting and a Gothic cathedral window, or the reliefs of Egypt and those of the Parthenon? If an art has boundaries at all, boundaries of its soul become form, they are historical and not technical or physiological boundaries. Footnote. Our pedantic method has given us an art history that excludes music history. And while the one has become a normal element of higher education, the other has remained an affair solely for the expert. It is just as though one tried to write a history of Greece without taking Sparta into account. The result is a theory of art that is a pious fraud. End of footnote. An art is an organism, not a system. There is no art genus that runs through all the centuries and all the cultures, even where, as in the case of the Renaissance, supposed technical traditions momentarily deceive us into a belief in the eternal validity of antique art laws, there is at bottom entire discrepancy. There is nothing in Greek and Roman art that stands in any relation whatever to the form language of a Donatello statue, or a painting of Signorelli, or a facade of Michelangelo. Inwardly, the Quattrocento is related to the contemporary Gothic, and to nothing else. The fact of the archaic Greek Apollo type being influenced by Egyptian portraiture, or early Tuscan representation by Etruscan tomb painting, implies precisely what is implied by that of Bach's writing a fugue upon an alien theme. He shows what he can express with it. Every individual art, Chinese landscape or Egyptian plastic or Gothic counterpoint, is once existent and departs with its soul and its symbolism never to return. 2. With this, the notion of form opens out immensely. Not only the technical instrument, not only the form language, but also the choice of art genus itself is seen to be an expression means. What the creation of a masterpiece means for an individual artist, the night watch for Rembrandt, or the Meistersinger for Wagner, that the creation of a species of art, comprehended as such, means for the life history of a culture. It is epochal. Apart from the merest externals, each such art is an individual organism without predecessor or successor. Its theory, technique and convention all belong to its character and contain nothing of eternal or universal validity. When one of these arts is born, when it is spent, whether it dies or is transmuted into another, why this or that art is dominant in or absent from a particular culture. All these are questions of form in the highest sense, just as is that other question of why individual painters and musicians unconsciously avoid certain shades and harmonies or, on the contrary, show preferences so marked that authorship attributions can be based on them. The importance of these groups of questions has not yet been recognized by theory, even by that of the present day. And yet it is precisely from this side, the side of their physiognomic, that the arts are accessible to the understanding. Hitherto it has been supposed, without the slightest examination of the weighty questions that the supposition involves, that the several arts specified in the conventional classification scheme, the validity of which is assumed, are all possible at all times and places. And the absence of one or another of them in particular cases is attributed to the accidental lack of creative personalities, or impelling circumstances, or discriminating patrons to guide art on its way. Here we have what I call a transference of the causality principle from the world of the become to that of the becoming. Having no eye for the perfectly different logic and necessity of the living, for destiny and the inevitableness and unique occurrence of its expression possibilities, men had recourse to tangible and obvious causes for the building of their art history, which thus came to consist of a series of events of only superficial concordance. I have already, in the earliest pages of this work, exposed the shallowness of the notion of a linear progression of mankind through the stages of ancient, medieval, and modern, a notion that has made us blind to the true history and structure of higher cultures. The history of art is a conspicuous case in point. Having assumed as self-evident the existence of a number of constant and well-defined provinces of art, one proceeded to order the history of these several provinces according to the equally self-evident scheme of an ancient, medieval, modern, to the exclusion, of course, of Indian and East Asiatic art, of the art of Aksum and Saba, of the Sassanids, and of Russia, which, if not omitted altogether, were at best relegated to appendices. It occurred to no one that such results argued unsoundness in the method. The scheme was there, demanded facts, and must at any price be fed with them. And so a futile up-and-down course was stolidly traced out. Static times were described as natural pauses. It was called decline when some great art in reality died, and Renaissance, where an eye really free from prepossessions would have seen another art being born in another landscape to express another humanity. Even today we are still taught that the Renaissance was a rebirth of the classical, and the conclusion was drawn that it is possible and right to take up arts that are found weak or even dead. In this respect, the present is a veritable battlefield, and set them going again by conscious reformation program, or forced revival. And yet it is precisely in this problem of the end, the impressively sudden end of a great art, the end of the Attic drama in Euripides, of Florentine sculpture with Michelangelo, of instrumental music in Liszt, Wagner and Bruckner, that the organic character of these arts is most evident. If we look closely enough, we shall have no difficulty in convincing ourselves that no one art of any greatness has ever been reborn. Of the pyramid style, nothing passed over into the Doric. Nothing connects the classical temple with the basilica of the Middle East. For the mere taking over of the classical column as a structural member, though to a superficial observer it seems a fact of the first importance, weighs no more in reality than Goethe's employment of the old mythology in the classical Walpurgis Night scene of Faust. To believe genuinely in a rebirth of classical art, or any classical art, in the Western 15th century requires a rare stretch of the imagination, and that a great art may die not merely with the culture, but within it, we may see from the fate of music in the classical world. Possibilities of great music there must have been in the Doric springtime. How otherwise can we account for the importance of old-fashioned Sparta in the eyes of such musicians as there were later? For Terpander, Thaletas and Alcman were effective there, when elsewhere the statuary art was merely infantile, and yet the late classical world refrained. In just the same fashion, everything that the Magian culture had attempted in the way of frontal portraiture, deep relief and mosaic, finally succumbed before the arabesque, and everything of the plastic that had sprung up in the shade of Gothic cathedrals at Chartres, Reims, Bamberg, Naumburg, in the Nuremberg of Peter Fischer and the Florence of Verrocchio vanished before the oil painting of Venice and the instrumental music of the Baroque. 3. The Temple of Poseidon at Festum and the Minster of Ulm, works of the ripest Doric and the ripest Gothic, differ precisely as the Euclidean geometry of bodily bounding surfaces differs from the analytical geometry of the position of points in space referred to spatial axes. All classical building begins from the outside, all Western from the inside. The Arabian also begins with the inside, but it stays there. There is one and only one soul, the Faustian, that craves for a style which drives through walls into the limitless universe of space and makes both the exterior and the interior of the building complementary images of one and the same world feeling. The exterior of the basilica and the domical building may be a field for ornamentation, but architecture it is not. The impression that meets the beholder as he approaches is that of something shielding, something that hides a secret. The form language in the cavern twilight exists for the faithful only. That is the factor common to the highest examples of the style and to the simplest Mithraean catacombs, the prime, powerful utterance of a new soul. Now, as soon as the Germanic spirit takes possession of the basilical type, there begins a wondrous mutation of all structural parts as to both position and significance. Here in the Faustian north, the outer form of the building, be it cathedral or mere dwelling house, begins to be brought into relation with the meaning that governs the arrangement of the interior, a meaning undisclosed in the mosque and non-existent in the temple. The Faustian building has a visage and not merely a façade, whereas the front of a peripteros is, after all, only one of four sides, and the centre-domed building in principle has not even a front. And with this visage, this head, is associated an articulated trunk that draws itself out through the broad plain like the cathedral at Speyer, or erects itself to the heavens like the innumerable spires of the original design of Reims. The motif of the façade, which greets the beholder and tells him the inner meaning of the house, dominates not only individual major buildings, but also the whole aspect of our streets, squares, and towns, with their characteristic wealth of windows. Footnote: the aspect of the streets of old Egypt may have been very similar to this, if we can draw conclusions from the tesserae discovered in Knossos. And the pylon is an undoubted and genuine façade. End of footnote. The great architecture of the early period is ever the mother of all following arts. It determines the choice of them and the spirit of them. Accordingly, we find that the history of the classical shaping art is one untiring effort to accomplish one single ideal, viz., the conquest of the freestanding human body as the vessel of the pure, real present. The temple of the naked body was to it what the cathedral of voices was to the Faustian, from earliest counterpoint to the orchestral writing of the 18th century. We have failed hitherto to understand the emotional force of this secular tendency of the Apollinian, because we have not felt how the purely material, soulless body, for the temple of the body too has no interior, is the object which archaic relief, Corinthian painting on clay, and Attic fresco were all striving to obtain until Polycletus and Phidias showed how to achieve it in full. We have, with a wonderful blindness, assumed this kind of sculpture as both authoritative and universally possible, as in fact the art of sculpture. We have written its history as one concerned with all peoples and periods, and even today our sculptors, under the influence of unproved Renaissance doctrines, speak of the naked human body as the noblest and most genuine object of the art of sculpture. Yet in reality, this statue art, the art of the naked body standing free upon its footing and appreciable from all sides alike, existed in the classical and the classical only. For it was that culture alone which quite decisively refused to transcend sense limits in favour of space. The Egyptian statue is always meant to be seen from the front. It is a variant of plain relief. And the seemingly classically conceived statues of the Renaissance, we are astounded as soon as it occurs to us to count them, to find how few of them there are nothing but a semi-Gothic reminiscence. Footnote: Ghiberti has not outgrown the Gothic, nor has even Donatello, and already in Michelangelo the feeling is Baroque, i.e. musical. End of footnote. The evolution of this rigorously non-spatial art occupies the three centuries from 650 to 350, a period extending from the completion of the Doric and the simultaneous appearance of a tendency to free the figures from the Egyptian limitation of frontalness to the coming of the Hellenistic and its illusion painting, which closed off the grand style. This sculpture will never be rightly appreciated until it is regarded as the last and highest classical, as springing from a plain art, first obeying and then overcoming the fresco. No doubt the technical origin can be traced to experiments in figure-wise treatment of the pristine column, or the plates that served to cover the temple wall. And no doubt there are here and there imitations of Egyptian works, seated figures of Miletus, although very few Greek artists can ever have seen one. Footnote. The first tendency is seen in the Samian Hera of Karamuis and the persistent turning of columns into caryatids, the second in the Delian figure dedicated to Artemis by Nicandra, with its relation to the oldest metope technique. End of footnote. But as a form ideal, the statue goes back through relief to the archaic clay painting in which fresco also originated. Relief, like fresco, is tied to the bodily wall. All this sculpture, right down to Myron, may be considered as relief detached from the plane. In the end, the figure is treated as a self-contained body apart from the mass of the building, but it remains essentially a silhouette in front of a wall. Footnote. Most of the works are pediment groups or metopes, but even the Apollo figures and the maidens of the Acropolis could not have stood free. End of footnote. Direction in depth is excluded, and the work is spread out frontally before the beholder. Even the Marsyas of Myron can be copied upon vases or coins without much trouble or appreciable foreshortenings. Consequently, of the two major late arts after 650, fresco definitely has the priority. The small stock of types is always to be found first in vase figuring, which is often exactly paralleled by quite late sculptures. We know that the centaur group of the West Pediment at Olympia was worked out from a painting. On the Aegina Temple, the advance from the West to the East Pediment is an advance from the fresco character to the body character. The change is completed about 460 with Polycletus, and thenceforward plastic groups become the model for strict painting. But it is from Lysippus that the wholly cubic and always treatment becomes thoroughly veristic and yields fact. Till then, even in the case of Praxiteles, we have still a lateral or planar development of the subject, with a clear outline that is only fully effective in respect of one or two standpoints. But an undeviating testimony to the picture origin of independent sculpture is the practice of polychroming the marble, a practice unknown to the Renaissance and to Classicism, which would have felt it as barbaric, and we may say the same of the gold and ivory statuary and the enamel overlaying of bronze, a metal which already possesses a shining golden tone of its own. Footnote. The decisive preference of the white stone is itself significant of the opposition of Renaissance to classical feeling. End of footnote.